Welcome to the On So Many Levels podcast, the podcast about collectibles, toys, games, and other fun stuff. I'm Chris.
I'm Steven.
And we're really happy to have you guys here today. We're going to jump into the news section. It's a new portion of our podcast that we're adding in our second episode. Let's talk about something not so great. On the 13th of July, Grant Imahara died. For those of you who don't know who that is one of the Mythbusters. One of my favorite ones, actually. He was I would call him the second scientist, along with Adam Savage. And they worked together quite a lot before Mythbusters.
Well, and I think they even, like, got more focus as, like, the traditionally scientific mind on the show than Adam did.
He was definitely my favorite in terms of, like, all the cool stuff he brought to the show. I loved all the robotics and, like, every time they did a car that they remote controlled from a distance, that was just awesome watching that stuff happen. It's really sad. I feel really terrible for the people that knew him close, like all the other Mythbusters, and especially Adam Savage. He did a little section on his podcast just recently talking about it, and it's pretty cool to hear about all the fun adventures they've been on in their life and things that they've done. I highly recommend people listen to that. I believe it's called the Still Untitled Podcast. I could be butchering that. I'll correct it later if it's wrong. In other news that's a little more uplifting, Ghosts of Tsushima. That's a really hard one for me to say.
Yeah. It always has been.
Tsushima.
Ghost of Tsushima.
There we go.
And I think it's actually Ghost.
Is it Ghost?
I think it's singular, I didn't find that out until last night. Watch, I'm going to be wrong now, because I was trying to say it and then I was reading it and it was
100% correct. It is Ghost
of Tsushima.
Oh man.
Please don't correct us.
I feel terrible. But that game came out and hopefully it's good. I'm going to play it. You'll be hearing this on Monday. This is recorded on Thursday the 16th, the day before it comes out. So maybe we'll talk about it in our next show and see if it's any good.
Yeah, I'm going to try and play it during this week.
Yeah, I will probably download it tonight after.
I hear it's if anything, it's a absolutely gorgeous game.
Yeah, it looked really beautiful.
And we had the fun opportunity of at least having something to do with it, not the game itself.
Yeah, we are technically making a statue for this game.
I just said that because I wasn't even sure if I was supposed to even mention it. So
yeah, it'll be a small one. It's obviously going to come out after the game. We did not have time to finish it beforehand, but we also worked on some parts and pieces for a one-to-one display piece for Sony, which was really fun. We actually have some parts at the shop right now getting worked on for that, so it's pretty cool. And then another thing that happened that was kind of big was a huge Twitter hack. You want to talk about that?
Apparently a lot of very famous people were their accounts were hacked, verified accounts were hacked, and Twitter had to shut down all posts and password change requests for the for verified users for some time. They said Twitter's claiming that it was an internal security flaw in their system, but and making sure not to pin it on any kind of ignorance of the account holders or anything like that, which I was pretty skeptical of at first. It makes sense that Twitter's not going to blame, like, its biggest
like Apple
personalities. Yeah, like Apple and Joe Biden, and I know Elon Musk is huge.
Yeah,
Kanye West. But then it seemed like former Facebook
just kidding
former Jesus. And then a former Facebook employee, a former Facebook executive that's also from Stanford. I think he's Stanford faculty or former Stanford faculty, seemed to back up that claim that after looking at it, that it was internally a Twitter security flaw, which I don't know. I feel like that's less comforting than
right.
If somebody gave up their, if it was a phishing scam or social engineering or something like that, then you're like, well, at least they didn't use a strong password or they clicked on a bad link. But now you're like, well, it's a now you've got a flaw in Twitter security.
Yeah.
And there was mention that it wasn't that there's a specific reason it seems that Trump's account wasn't targeted, and that's because there are extra security measures that have apparently been put into place
because he's the president.
Trump's account because he's the president. And apparently there's been things that have happened in the past that required him to do that. I don't know if it's things that actually happened or things that he claimed to happen.
Be nice if we all got those
security measures. That'd be cool. Cause I mean, it's not him. Even if he's president, I mean, I still imagine that the things that Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Apple,
right,
Michael Bloomberg, the things they say can also have pretty adverse effects on the economy and stock markets and things like that.
Yeah.
But they seem to think that it was one person, which was pretty interesting, because at first it was, well, maybe it's Russia or North Korea, Iran, places like that.
For a Bitcoin scam?
Yeah, well, I guess North Korea actually deals pretty heavily in Bitcoin. That's something I was ignorant to, but it makes sense.
Sense to me, but elaborate, please.
Because they're not really... the world's free markets aren't really open to North Korea. Also, North Korea's currency is basically worthless. So they have to find other ways to purchase things that also can't be traced back to North Korea, or else sanctions can be put in place against companies or institutions that do business with them.
So therein lies Bitcoin. That makes sense.
So then use Bitcoin. Okay. So they thought that, but then I guess the reason they decided that that wasn't the case was the level of sophistication. I mean, to me, it still seemed pretty sophisticated to exploit a flaw like that and gain access to all these accounts.
Yeah.
But it was, I think, the nature of it where they're trying to get people to send a famous the quote from the New York Times was, send a famous person Bitcoin and get double your money back, which sounded hilarious. If you fell for that scam, you're hilarious.
Yeah, I feel bad for you, but I also don't.
Yeah, so they're like, well, maybe that's not what government is trying to extract from Americans. Is just Bitcoin. And the reason they didn't think that was because they would probably try, and these governments I'm talking about would try and target things like disrupting our politics, our social situations that are happening right now, or influence those kinds of social movements, or more specifically our economy, like things that may affect the stock market, statements from those people.
So they wouldn't put together a poorly structured sentence asking for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Glad that they got it sorted to some degree.
Yeah. I don't think I actually think a lot of the accounts still don't have access, and they're not because they apparently gained Twitter, got the accounts back, locked them, and then immediately lost them again to the hacker.
Why don't they just apply the same methods they put on the president's thing to get them back?
And that's good, right? Yeah, that's something I don't know. I mean, two-factor authentication, maybe.
I'll reach out to Twitter and see what they say.
Do we need three-factor authentication? So, yeah, that was pretty strange. And I mean, Twitter's got some really smart people, and it's a really sophisticated company. Yeah. Even if the content that comes out isn't always the case, but so it's kind of alarming. These kinds of things are going to happen more and more. And
yay,
these kind of things actually, they kind of stress me out when I think about, but then I'm
good thing my follower count on Twitter is like 30 people or something. So
yeah, so that might be more than me. So
yeah, I'm not worried about it. Even our business one is not. We haven't grown Twitter very large.
Yeah.
I mean, Instagram's been our main focus.
It just makes me worry about just personal protection.
People who actually have security. Something to say.
Yeah. Like, it's not Twitter. Now it's your bank account.
Yeah.
Because if you're using, I don't even know if Twitter offers two-factor authentication. That's how much I use it.
But we could Google it.
Yeah, we could.
but we're not going to. You guys can figure that out for yourself.
Anyway.
So that's the news for the week. I'm sure there's other things that happened, but that's the stuff that caught our eye.
Tons of things, but 45 minutes won't cover it, I don't think.
So in today's episode, we're going to talk about 3D printing tech now versus what it was like a few years ago versus what it was like a long time ago? Because I'm sure a lot of you don't really know how long 3D printing's been around. It's actually been around since the 80s. But we'll talk about that on a different episode, the history of 3D printing. What I want to talk about is how the current market of desktop resin-based 3D printers are completely changing the entire industry. Right now, you can buy a very high-quality printer for $250. It's called the Frozen Sonic Mini, and it prints at a higher resolution than the Form 2. By Form Labs, which was
impressive.
A really nice printer. It was a standard for a while for a lot of companies to buy that, like dental companies and a lot of other collectibles companies and people that I know bought that. We had a bunch. We still do have a bunch of them. We don't use them much anymore. But this $250 printer prints at a higher resolution and like 10 times faster. It's a smaller build platform for sure, but it is crazy. Like knowing that you can buy something for $250 that outperforms like a $3,500
now
machine.
Cheaper to 3D print at a high resolution than it is to get black ink for your HP printer.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts. Another good example would be the Frozen Transform or the equivalent in Piopoli's line called the Phenom. They're a large, they call them large format printers. It's huge. Has a huge print volume. I believe it was $1,800 when we bought our, we have two of them.
So explain also for other people that might not have really an idea what a, like a, what a large print volume really consists
yeah,
of.
I don't have the number on hand, but let me use this magical tool that we have.
Well, even just from experience, because like you might say large print volume.
It's and like then, bigger than a shoebox.
Yeah.
Whereas the Form 2, again, I'll use that because that was pretty much the gold standard for a while, is like 5 by 5 by 7 inches, I believe. And the Frozen Transform, I don't want to butcher it. We've already butchered enough. I'm going to pull it up. So bear with me, all of you in the audience.
Well, when I first saw like what a like large format printer was years ago, something that had a bed that was like 8 by 13 or something like that was
right
expensive and huge, at least from
yeah
from I mean our understanding.
Our first printer was an old Stratasys 260V
Eden 260V,
yeah, which I mean still a good printer, not to today's standards by any means. It prints well for certain parts but not for collectibles or high definition miniatures. But that thing retailed at like over $120,000. Yeah. We got ours for, I think like just under 20. We got a lucky deal on eBay and it did us well for the first couple of years.
But I mean, we had, and it was amazing for what we needed, but we yeah. didn't also at the time have the means to get anything else. So no. really have enough experience to realize.
The only other options were like Envision Techs and yeah. $200,000 printers yeah. or 3D systems printers that are crazy expensive, and you have to lock yourself into an insane payment plan that would, you know, it's just nuts.
And then like your service plans and
yeah. my God. And then the Form 2 came out and we got one of those during the very first batch, I believe. And it did wonders for us. It was great. Still a lot of post-processing issues and everything else that you experience with 3D printing. But what's really amazing is now that you can get a printer that can, I believe you can fit, or close to, you can fit an entire Form 2 inside of the Transform, like pretty close.
Yeah.
For less than the price of the Form 2, and it prints at a higher resolution. So the Form 2 is printing at 145 micron resolution in the XY axis, and the Transform prints at, I believe, 74 or 75 in the XY.
Well, and this is also more of a question than a statement, is the technology behind the high resolution printers, it's really, a lot of it's pretty old technology, right?
Right.
As far as like the,
for the SLA stuff. Yeah. So the laser printers have been around for, that was actually one of the first printers created. And that technology hasn't changed much. I mean, it's gotten tighter, so to speak. And somewhat more affordable, but realistically, the laser spot size can only get so small.
And that's why I'm asking as well, is that that's really just like a focus, how small you can make that laser to focus on a specific point, right?
Right. And then you're also dealing with things like mirrors that are moving. So if any amount of dust gets on those, you get weird refractions mm-hmm. and issues in your print. And so there's a lot of variables and moving parts. And now with these, I hate to like use the term cheap Chinese printers, but that's exactly what they are. They're coming out of China. Most of the companies are based in China or Taiwan, and they're inexpensive. They're well made, but they're using really inexpensive parts that are super clever, like LCD screens.
That's kind of where I was coming from, is like the LCD technology, not brand new at all.
No.
DLP technology, not brand new.
Nope.
Lasers are cooler than they used to be, but not brand new.
Yeah.
So it seems like the hardware was always there to a degree. It's that
right.
The software and I guess maybe the resin compounds. I don't know if the resin composition has anything.
Yeah, they're subtly different. The wavelength of the resin curing is slightly different from an SLA to what is, I guess they call them an MSLA, or just a LCD based printing system. They're slightly different. One cures at 365 nanometers of light and the other one cures at 405. So I think you have to have more power if mm-hmm. you're, you know, using a laser, but, the biggest thing is time. So beyond size and cost and all that stuff, which are both of those are really important issues, you know, having the ability to own more printers than you could before because they're cheaper. And then having larger printers so you can print larger objects is amazing in high resolution. But then having those prints come off the print bed in a quarter of the time that you would have a Form 2 chugging away is amazing. And I've done this test multiple times. We have so many printers in the shop.
Yeah.
And we have... You know, we have some SLA machines. We have, we do have a few DLP based machines that are pretty decent. And then we also have some LCD based machines. And we have the new monochrome LCD based machines, which are only showing a black and white image. So they can cure the resin like six times faster. It's insane. So doing like a small, like let's say like a quarter scale head for a statue on a Form 2 will look good, but it will take 8 to 12 hours to 16 hours, depending on the, you know, what the object is. That same object, though, in like the transform might take 6 hours. And then in the frozen Sonic Mini or the frozen Sonic XL, which we have as well, it takes 2.5, which is amazing. And they come out looking better. So it's better looking, faster. The resin's cheaper. Everything about it is better.
Well, I remember when we first started getting some stuff with to print on the Eden, that it was literally an all day or all night. I mean,
yeah,
you're getting up in the middle of the night every day to make sure something's coming off the printer, that it's checking on it throughout the night to make sure there's no errors.
Back in the garage days.
And then you're on one printer, and I mean, the quality as far as like the build lines and the surface detail was good. Like we thought it was really good. It was good. We made it work, but it was
no better.
Yeah. It's crazy how much that has changed by itself. So I can't imagine if we were at one printer still.
Yeah.
Like that would be a completely different game if it was still stuck with one printer or having to come up with the capital to buy five printers at over $100,000 a piece.
Yeah. I think it's amazing that you could essentially, if you wanted to, you could open up a print shop by just buying a transform or two, and you could do decent on your own. I mean, you still need the know-how, the elbow grease, and all the other stuff that comes with actually processing a prototype professionally for a company, but you could do it on a more amateur level for, let's say, people on Etsy who want stuff printed and they want to mold and cast it, but they don't have a big enough printer. You can easily provide that service and make money, whereas 5 years ago, you couldn't do that. I mean, you could do it with the Form 2, but it wasn't affordable.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd be out a considerable amount of money up front for a Form 2 and the wash station and all that stuff that they came with. But now, I mean, there's a litany of different, there's so many brands and they're all good. I mean, I think most of them use the same hardware, to be honest. So I can't imagine it being that different from printer to printer, but they definitely perform really well. And what's nice is that, like, for us as a business, it's fantastic because we can have our higher quality printers. There's some air quotes there,
yeah,
that no one can see, that we have for very specific tasks, but then we run everything else on these, you know, inexpensive printers that do a wonderful job and they produce high quality product, you know, and especially now we're getting into miniatures. It's amazing what you can do with like the Frozen Sonic XL. That thing is awesome. It's 50 microns in the XY, which is very, very good. That's on par with the standard for miniature printing for the longest time has been EnvisionTech printers.
Well, that would have been that would have been nearly impossible barrier for us to get through, yeah, to miniatures if we didn't have these kinds of printers at
right.
the prices that they're available.
I think the standard is like the EnvisionTech pre-factory or something, or per factory. And I think they start, you can find a used one for like $9,000 or something. But if you want to go buy a new one with the proper lens and all this stuff in a tiny build volume, the build volume is like 2 inches by 3 inches by 2 inches or something. It's really small. It's for jewelry. That ends up costing you like $100,000.
Well, that's not. And even if you have your ridiculously expensive service agreement with some of the manufacturers, you still, like, we had instances where it's like printer goes down. That's great if you have a service agreement and it's under warranty right. and stuff, but you're still without production.
Yeah, and they're not as reliable as they would seem. Like, I feel like the sub $3,000 printers are more reliable than that Stratasys Eden that we have out there. I mean, that thing died on us so many times for just stupid reasons, because it's got a million moving parts and vacuum pumps and
just, well, and then having to have a dedicated desktop,
yeah,
specifically for that was kind of
completely antiquated at this point. Like, well, I mean,
yeah,
we haven't used it in 2 years. It sits in the garage. I think it's just there to put stuff on
for selfish reasons too. I like the fact that the market is the entry level for the market is a little bit lower for people, that the cost is a lot lower as well, even yeah. for hobbyists, for one reason, so that when people see that you 3D print stuff and they look at the finished product, they can also now, when they try for themselves, go, wow, there's a lot of work that still goes
right.
into getting yeah. a good quality print and then getting a professional prototype out.
Yeah, and there's a lot of really cool businesses that are doing some great things, and especially the miniatures world, that are offering like monthly subscriptions for pre-supported miniatures. All you have to do is slap them on your printer and hit go, and their print settings are already built in. They're really nice. The supports just fall right off. That is really cool. That's a cool thing for people, but it's still, when you throw primer on it, I mean, it's not perfect. These things are better, so I want to make sure that everyone listening understands that, like, we're praising these printers, they're still not perfect. So when your print comes off, there's work to be done. But for your common hobbyist or person who wants pieces on a table to play with, they look great. If you're going to make something for production, it takes a considerable amount of work to make it look perfect and, in my opinion, acceptable for like mass production.
And there's, I mean, a significant amount of, before anything ever gets printed, just a significant amount of time and effort that goes into just engineering the
right.
models for print as well.
Yeah. I mean, there should be, but unfortunately, like, especially in the miniatures world, that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
They just print it as a whole piece because it's so small that cutting and keying parts is hard.
Yeah.
And I don't mean necessarily hard in the program. It's hard to put a 3 millimeter hand or a 2 millimeter hand onto a,
it's hard, you know, to
2 millimeter
I mean
arm.
It's hard to so. Engineer it, like, it's because yeah. I think it's like engineering anything, is where you can't just do the same thing you did on the last one because every piece is unique,
right?
And then you start, you when you see people cutting and keying, you're like, that's actually pretty tough. The act of it isn't designing where your cuts and keys are going to go seems like a pain in the ass.
Yeah, it can be. And I mean, the other thing that's really interesting is seeing how much more prototyping slash printing is being done in the States now as a whole, not necessarily professionally, but just in general. Like, there's more and more people adopting resin printers. There's been a huge for a while now in the maker community. There's been a gigantic amount of people using FDM printers. That's, I mean, we know that for sure, especially cosplayers and the like. But resin printers have always kind of been shied away from because they're messy. They were expensive. But now that all that stuff is coming down, cost is coming down, there's even water washable resins that exist that are not non-toxic. Again, some air quotes there. I don't know how non-toxic a resin is, but it's water washable, which tells me that it, at least it's a different compound than
it's not a petroleum resin, base is, or anything
right,
like that.
Which is pretty cool. There's a lot of cool stuff. So I think it's a good thing. I mean, I say that with a question mark because it also, as a business, the cheaper things become, it lets other businesses pop up and that's more competition. But that's where the backside of what we do, the back end, is really
that's
important.
Where quality, you know? Quality really helps. And then, but then it also benefits us in a way as being able to offer miniatures when you can just offer somebody something you design and they can print and do with it what they like.
Yeah.
That allows that still allows us to reach a lot more people.
Right. And I think what's really cool too is like with our miniature line, we're going to be offering, you know, physical miniatures that we're producing in house, which is a fantastic thing, resin cast, all that stuff. But then we're also going to offer the downloadable version for them to print if they have a printer, because I mean, that just hits everybody.
Yeah.
You either want to paint one that's already made or you want to print one at your scale, whatever scale you want, and paint it up yourself, which I think is awesome. The other thing too is with these printers getting better and better, there has been, you know, new technology that's increased the actual, just the quality of the output. So in turn, our like statues from every company are getting better and better. More details are possible, finer details are possible. Things that at like 1/10 scale 10 years ago you wouldn't see. You know, again, I mean, we talked about Bowen in our last one, but Bowen statues were amazing, but they don't have textural detail, right? Because that just wasn't a thing at the time.
Yeah.
Now you look at Iron Studios 1/10 scale and there's textures everywhere. It's beautiful. We're doing some stuff in 1/10 scale as well that I'm surprised when I pull the pieces off the printer, looking at like a head that is, you know, the size of my thumbnail and it's got wrinkles and pores and teeth.
You're like, this looks as good as a quarter scale statue. Yeah.
It's insane. I mean, to say the least, that's like the only word I can think of. It's insane that we're getting these type of results, especially off cheaper printers. I mean, that all kind of ties it in together, right? It's cheaper, but better, more advanced. It's amazing. And I think moving forward, we're going to see in the next like 2 to 3 years, we're likely going to see some really huge leaps in the monochrome side of things. So I'm predicting like once 8K screens start to become a thing / affordable,
yeah,
that they'll be put into printers, obviously. But what will be cool is to see, because I like the big printers for large objects. It's really cool, like making, you know, a full helmet or a 1-to-1 scale gun or something. But what really makes me excited is when I see a smaller size printer that already has high resolution that just keeps getting better and better. So I'd like to see, you know, something that's in the realm of the 4x5x6 inch build plate that can do 20 micron XY as opposed to 50, which at some point there's probably some diminishing returns I'm not going to notice, but that will be the perfection zone where you don't see a build line. Like that is the exciting thing to me, is at some point we are going to have prints that truly do not have build lines, which removes a significant portion of post-processing.
And I like to challenge anybody who has statues 1/6 quarter scale, at home in their collection and stuff, open them up to even the stuff that you think is just absolutely gorgeous. And it doesn't mean it's not, but you think it's flawless. And then at once you've seen enough prints come off of a printer and you've worked with enough, trying to buff out enough build lines on things, you then start to look at the stuff that you own and that's in production, and you can find build lines all over the place.
Yeah. If anything's been 3D printed, there's bound to be build lines left over somewhere. Usually they're in hard to reach places like armpits and the crooks of necks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I'm sure our stuff has some at some point. I mean, we try to be perfectionists, but it's almost impossible to remove every single build line.
I mean, especially if a heavily textured area.
Yeah.
You might not notice it at first, but once you, if you look closely, usually you can see like, you'll, wow, there's them. A build lines because it's just, you want to get rid of the texture, or you want to get rid of the build line. So you got to find a happy medium.
Yeah. It's just part of the process, I think. But it makes me happy. Like I said, it's really cool to see what the industry is doing, to see all the advancements. And it's not like long spans of time. I mean, within the last 6 months, there's been 4 or 5 printers that have come out that just blow my mind. I own 2 of them personally, 2 of the Frozen Sonic minis, because I print miniatures at home and they're awesome. I love that I can walk out, put a miniature on there, and within like an hour and a half, I have a beautiful miniature ready to go.
Well, when you show me something that you printed, a miniature that you printed, and something that you've purchased, the only difference I can tell is it seems like the one that you printed looks better.
Sometimes.
The ones that have come in some of the collections. But if you're just, it's like, I can't tell the difference when I just look at it, and I don't print them, and I don't really have like a whole bunch of miniatures. So it's, if I look, when I saw yours, I was like, oh, you just printed that here? That's amazing looking.
Yeah. I mean, when you really look at something, there's still issues, right? But it's the same amount of cleanup I think you'd have either way. So
yeah.
It's like you get a resin cast miniature from a reputable company, does a good job. There's still going to be little boogers and, you know, seam lines and stuff from where they cast it. Not everything's perfect. Or maybe you're the unlucky guy that gets, you know, the one random QC person who decided to phone it in that day, and you get a bunch of errors or bubbles or, you know, pockets where the resin didn't flow. It's the same thing with printing, right? You still have to clean up the support nubs. But those are, I mean, if you do it right, I mean, I've been watching this YouTuber 3D printing pro, and his stuff is amazing. Like he actually calls it support porn for a reason, because it's like when you watch him take a piece off, it just falls off and there's nothing left. And that to me that's an art, first of all. And it's also a headache, because doing that, I've done that for some of our stuff, most of our stuff, and it takes forever. Like setting up, we're working on a little Knoll warrior for our miniatures line. He's got hair everywhere.
Yeah.
And so every little flyaway hair I have to support, and it, unless I want support nubs on his face, which I don't, I want them in the key area and the back of the head. So to do that, I mean, I think the setup process for that one little tiny piece, which in physical space is less than an inch long, took me like 6.5 hours. Like it was a ridiculous amount of time, because I wanted to make it perfect. I wanted to make it to where there was no cleanup. You just twist it gently and
like it came off of a printer.
Yeah. And it worked, but it takes practice and time and know-how, and you have to know the programs, and there's so many different programs. But that's, you know, another topic for another show, I think. It's talking about those programs, which are, again, right alongside the printers, are getting better and better. You know, and it used to be that I wished I could print on different printers, but use Preform, which was provided by Form Labs, and just export their stuff into other printers. That was never possible.
And I think once you've reached that, maybe the hardware limitations, where you start getting diminishing returns on the hardware, it's then going to be the software that's going to lure people in and give them better access, because it'll be like, before, to just use an analogy of, for software development in general, was before, when I first started developing software, it was, you had to use Objective-C for Apple products.
Right.
That was not, that's, I mean, other people might think so, but that was not a very intuitive language. It wasn't terribly easy, and it was really hard to find people that knew how to use it. And then started to come, and then you found these frameworks and stuff that came together in libraries and like Lua and scripting languages. So that's why you have so many people that can develop apps now,
yeah,
which seem like, wow, that's a professional looking app. It must be a really good programmer. And they might be, but it's like they don't need any of that low level knowledge that you needed, yep, for C and Objective-C. And I think that's kind of what'll probably happen too with printing.
That's what was happening with Formlabs. I mean, I will give them credit where credit's due. They made good machines. There's some issues, and I've known a lot of people that had machines that just straight up had problems from day one. But for the most part, they are like the Apple of 3D printing. Their stuff works. Their software is intuitive. It's super easy. But as these other companies have grown, Formlabs hasn't. They haven't really changed much. And so it seems that they've added a couple more printers in their line. We also have those, and they're not great. And the problem with that is like it's just disheartening when you see, you know, a $3,500 printer sit on a shelf that doesn't get used nearly as much as the $1,200 printer right next to it that prints faster, better, you know. And I wish that they took the same. I feel like the software they developed for the Formlab side of things is so good that if they took that same concept and put it in their hardware, it would be better. Like, you would have a really good combination. But right now you have decent hardware that's easily eclipsed, and then you have really good software that I wish was open source and you could use it on all the other printers, because that would make my life
and
so
that's
much
really the you need to have that. You need somebody to come along with that open source software that just blows everybody's mind.
Yeah, like, I mean, I'm excited for it. So right now most of these printers operate off of Chitubox. I think it's the company is Chitubox. But it is pretty intuitive. It's simple. It doesn't have a lot of advanced functions in terms of like automation. But if you know what you're doing, you can set a print up relatively quickly. It has hollowing features, which is nice. That used to be not a thing in most of the resin-based softwares. But they have a pro version coming out, and I don't know much about it, and I don't know when it's coming out. It's just like it's been teased on their website for a couple months. So I'm excited to see what they offer with the pro version, because I think it's only gonna be like $100, which is not expensive a decent piece of software. But if it adds things like better automatic support placement or like a smarter version of that, it'll be worth it alone for most people who are printing.
And $100 is not expensive for software in general.
Not when the leading printing software, just so everybody knows out there, for the last like 15 years has been Magix, and that is $20,000. That's insane. It's a good piece of software, I guess, but it's being eclipsed as well by free pieces of software.
Yeah, when you sell a piece of software as a engineering software, then it becomes, you can then sell it to these companies that are like, well, we don't really have another choice. Here's 20 grand, right. 40 grand, 100 grand. I remember my dad had brought home a piece of software once that he had to get through his work to work on. In the early 90s, that was a $750,000 piece of software on this on a couple of floppy disks. And I was like, just be careful with that, because it wasn't as easy. He couldn't just go download a copy because he had a license or anything. He's like, this is $750,000. And I was like, good Lord.
Why?
Yeah. What? And then
that's crazy.
But then you see once you can start targeting mass market and hobbyists and stuff, you're like, well, that's not realistic now.
Well, what I like is the I tend to call it the old world. It's the like when you go to buy a piece of machinery or something, you have to call and talk to a sales agent still. That's what these older, bigger print companies are still doing, like Stratasys, Envision Tech. Like, you can't find a price for one online unless you really, really, really dig. You have to call and talk to somebody. You have to get a service plan. You have to get all these antiquated things that we don't need anymore. On top of that, they're really smart. They have to sell you Magix to operate their machine. or a version of yeah. something like that, where it's you have the printer and then you have this added cost of a piece of software that runs a printer, and then you got to buy a dedicated computer that runs a printer. It's nonsense. I mean, that whole thing, I can't believe they're still in business. I can't believe any of those companies are still in business. But they, what's funny is who they market to is other old, like old world businesses.
Well, and that's the thing, is those companies get stuck. They just get comfortable with the technology. You also have people overseeing the procurement of the technology that aren't really familiar with that. They might be familiar with manufacturing and manufacturing process and kind of like the old ways, but they're not really familiar with what's available to them, or they're also not interested in overhauling their operation to cut costs right now, or in the, or rather over the long term, significantly cut costs. They're just like, you know what? It's easier to call my guy at Envision Tech and just have him, or Stratasys. Yeah. I'll just email my guy. He'll send us. I mean, I still see it all the time where you see a contract come over or a quote come over and you're like, you guys are just signing off, not with Level 52. But you're like, you're just signing off on this. This is $400,000. And I'm looking through this and you guys aren't even looking for other options. You just go, this is what we've used. We're comfortable. Yeah. Sign off. The check will get signed. Nobody's going to yell at me.
And by all means, you know, for clarity, like we're not, the collectibles industry is different, right? So we're a newer industry when it comes to 3D printing. So we're not so entrenched in those old ways, but there are definitely things like that, those $250,000 machines can do that a $1,800 machine can't do.
Yeah.
One of those things is dimensional accuracy. So, I mean, we haven't touched on a lot of things. We've just kind of knocked on these expensive printers, but we're directly comparing that stuff to what we do, which is collectibles, toys, miniatures, you know, little things that are fun and exciting and not potentially saving a life or holding a building up or inside of an airplane.
Well, and we had to use one of those for our the stuff that we do. So,
and it was cool. I mean, it was always accurate. I mean, that's one thing I'll say is it didn't fail the prints. And when the prints came out, they were definitely the right measurements. Albeit they weren't the prettiest looking prints, but I think when you're looking for, you know, part dimensional accuracy and very specific types of prints, those really expensive printers do make sense. But I do think that as these other printers get better and better, the LCD stuff gets more accurate. They figure out a way to, you know, a lot of these printers are, is it bottom up, right? Where they're printing on a bed and it goes down into a vat and it pulls it up. They're fighting gravity. They're fighting suction, all that stuff. There's other printers like the Milkshake, which builds down into a vat, which is very traditional. That's actually how a lot of the high-end SLA machines work, because you need less supports to support your object as it goes down into a giant vat of resin. Once that concept becomes easier to pull off for these other companies, we're going to start seeing more of that because you get higher-end results, and then you also get better dimensional accuracy.
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll start seeing that at some point. Probably not with LCDs, obviously, because that'll be a really weird situation to put an LCD right on top of a vat of resin. Very strange. But you'll see it with more and more DLPs, especially as 4K DLPs become, you know, cheaper. They're still very expensive. I think that's it for the day. I appreciate everyone who tuned in. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Simplecast. Also on our website at www.onsomanylevels.com. We can also be found on Instagram at level52_studios and at Broken Anvil Miniatures. I'm Chris.
I'm Steven. Thanks for coming and listening to our podcast.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Bye.